around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Well, not really. And no one could ever even begin to come close to replacing Peter Godbold. But this is continuing coverage of the Democratic National Convention, live from the Pepsi Center in Denver. Mark Levine is there. Hey, Mark.
Hey, listen, I don't know that I could fill Peter's shoes, but I'll do my best. You know, I may not be as gay as Peter, but I can say the word fabulous, right?
Absolutely.
So I will try to be fabulous during these 2 hours. And even to talk about a few gay issues. But obviously, the heart of this is the convention. I am sitting here live at the Pepsi Center in Denver. It is extremely loud. If I'm talking too loud, it's because it's hard to hear myself talk. And we're waiting for the two big moments of the night. And that, of course, is Ted Kennedy. If he is still doing well enough to come. Of course, Ted Kennedy is suffering from a very vicious brain tumor. This may be his swan song tonight. And then following him is Michelle Obama. So those are the two big guests of the night, and plenty of others to come.
Well, it is, and it's only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger as the week progresses. And we know that you will be sitting in for Peter at least tonight and tomorrow night. And
Peter's welcome to join us. I understand he's a little under the weather tonight, but I'd love to hear Peter's comments on something.
He's had a hurricane on top of his house. You don't know what you know not the accuracy of what you say when you say he's been under the weather.
Huh.
The weather has been smack dab on top of him.
I didn't know that Faye was where he was.
Well, it wasn't until it looped back and decided to, you know, it zigged across Florida, then it zagged back.
I didn't realize that. I'm sorry to hear that. I assume he's okay.
He told me he got Faye dropped a tree limb on his car, and he was without power for like 24, 36 hours. It was maddening, but he had a portable generator that was generously made available to him by a listener sometime back, and that got him through it.
Wow. See, now that's why we have to be nice to our listeners. You never know when they'll be nice to us.
Well,
that's very kind of whoever that was.
Yes, it was. And it really, really did save him in many ways because he was able to keep a couple of fans going. Because even when you're getting hammered by a hurricane there in late August, it's still hotter than bejesus.
They're showing right now. You know, it's interesting to me. They're showing troops and things like that and people building homes. I wonder how much of this is to get the time just right. I mean, I don't know. It's 7 o'clock here. It's, I guess, 9 o'clock where you are on the East Coast, well, or close to the East Coast, Bob, in the Eastern time zone, at least. I think they're waiting to get Kennedy in more prime time. I mean, you're prime time in the East and Central time, but I assume they want to get him into prime Pacific time, too.
And that's a little bit of a challenge because there is a three-hour difference there.
Right, between the West and the East. Of course, we're 2 hours earlier. They're showing right now, interesting, they're showing veterans who are rebuilding homes, and they're showing other veterans without legs, without arms. It's quite powerful.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. We're coming up in a matter of, what, 6 days? We'll be on the third anniversary of Katrina.
Wow.
And
how many years in the Iraq War? What, five, six? I've lost count. 6 years.
Yeah.
More than 6 years.
I mean, and that's a sort of a very visceral representation of what a gang of screw ups the Bush administration are. I don't know where you stand on it, Mark, but I think Katrina was certainly a matter of gross indifference or willful neglect. And you know, and some people believe it was intentional. And
I do know, I know this, Bob. I know that Barbara Bush, mother of the current president, wife of the former president, I heard her. I remember playing her clips as she was looking at the victims of Katrina in the Houston Astrodome. Many had lost all of their belongings. Some had lost a number of members of their family, made it with just the shirt on their back in the Houston Astrodome. And I remember Barbara Bush saying very clearly, oh, well, you know, some of these people, they were quite poor. They're happy to be here.
Oh, they're doing quite well, really. Oh, I remember.
We're just afraid they're going to stay.
I know.
So, you know, when you have that for a mother, I guess the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree.
Oh, God.
Hey, Bob, right now we have sort of two ordinary Americans, Mike and Cheryl Fisher from Indiana. They hosted Barack Obama for lunch. Do you want me to cut to them?
Yeah, let's give them a listen.
We'll hear what they have to say.
All right. Sounds good.
But I'm here tonight because I've met Barack, and he understands what people like my wife and I are going through. Back before the Indiana primary, we got a call from the campaign. They asked us if we'd mind if the senator and his wife, Michelle, stopped by the next day and talked with us. When I saw the motorcade driving up the street, I was a nervous wreck. But as soon as Barack Obama came up on our front porch and shook my hand, he put me at ease. He told me, Mike, I'm not here to talk to you about my plans. I'm here to talk to you and to listen to you and your family. We went inside, and Barack put his elbows up on the table and listened. I've been a machinist with Amtrak for more than 20 years. I told Barack how I might lose my job because there are plans to move 77 jobs out of the state. I told him that we can't move because Beech Grove, Indiana is our home. It's where we've raised our family. There are just too many Hoosiers facing futures like ours, and many of their jobs are leaving the country. Barack and Michelle listened, and they understood. It was like talking with family. It became clear that they are regular people. Barack and Michelle grew up dealing with the same challenges most of us face. They were raised by working folks, and it's pretty clear that he can relate to working people and those who are struggling. This guy is not the typical politician who will tell you anything to get your vote. Barack is the real deal. He tells you what we need to hear, like John McCain's gas tax proposal, isn't the answer. Barack Obama has been willing to speak the truth, that it is just designed to win elections, not fix our energy problems. So here's what I have to say about Barack. He listens, he understands, he is sincere, and he has a good sense of humor. Barack Obama is the only person I trust to do the right thing for all of us. That's why I'm here tonight. And that's why he's my choice for president.
I was kind of hoping the wife would speak. She just sort of stood there, but I thought what he had to say was pretty good. I mean, it was very much from the heart. One thing, though, I guess I wish they wouldn't do is this poor man, this machinist, was reading from a teleprompter probably for the first time in his life, and he still had kind of a glassy-eyed look. Let's hear the president of the SEIU. He's speaking right now.
Okay. Is this a local or is this Andy Stern?
Hold on. This is Tom Bolinoff. I don't know him, but he's the president of the local in Chicago.
Okay, great.
For yourself and your family and create better opportunities for your children. My parents, like many other working families, were able to own a home and car and put their children through college. Back then, in that city of big shoulders, the Chicago of the 50s and 60s and 70s, the American dream was a reality. But by the early 1980s, as our economy globalized, the steel industry was in decline, and industrial plants all over the country, and especially in Chicago, were closing. That's what Barack Obama found when he moved to Chicago in 1984. On the south side of Chicago, in the aftermath of steel plant closing, this enormously talented man, who undoubtedly had many other opportunities, chose Yeah.
Okay, some audio difficulties coming from Denver right now. I'm hoping it'll clear up in a second or two. Just one second. Well, that's very, very odd. Okay. You there? Are you there, Mark? Okay, we're going to sort this out in a second. I'm waiting for Mark to come back. Oh, this is really annoying. Okay. Okay, Mark, I'm not hearing you. You're very, very broken up. Yeah, let's try a reconnect, and for the moment, we'll hopefully get things reestablished. And we'll reestablish our connection here and hope for the best. Please stand by. This is, you know, in a way, it doesn't get much more fun than this. So, hopefully, you are okay. Mark, are you there?
I am. Are we better now?
Ah, you're all fixed.
Okay, good. It's very, very loud right now. So, I hope I'm not screaming into the microphone. But
no, your audio is perfect.
Okay, because like I said, it's hard for me to hear my own voice with all this noise. This is where headphones, the kind that radio people wear, become very useful. Otherwise, I would never hear you.
Oh, yeah. You get the noise-canceling, noise-isolating ones are critical in a situation like that.
And I have you up really loud. I hope I don't have ear problems when all this is done. It's interesting. Now they have a clock up. I swear, it's like a commercial. It says, the convention resumes in 1:13, 12, 11, 110, 109.
Oh, I wanted to mention something to you, Mark, in the interim. You know, there's been so much made of the right wing. Wow, you know, Obama's an elitist. Wah, 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 you know, all of that stuff. Did you hear about John McCain going for coffee?
No, I didn't. Tell me about it.
It was a quiet weekend down at the McCain mansion. And at one point, he decided he wanted a cup of coffee. I wish I was kidding. This was all accounted in the Los Angeles Times. John McCain led a 9-car motorcade to Starbucks to get one cup of coffee.
Oh, you know what? I did read something like that. I do remember now. That's right. But I don't know why he needed a motorcade. I don't get it.
Well, because, you know, if he leaves, you know, the Johnny on the spot for-profit media press corps have to follow him, because he might say he might declare an important policy position on the free trade agreement with Colombia that'll make coffee so much cheaper for all of us.
Couldn't he send one of his lackeys out to get the coffee for him?
Well, let's see, he's a man of the people and he can get his own coffee.
I got to tell you, next up is going to be Caroline Kennedy, then a video. And then Ted Kennedy himself, she's coming out, and the applause is deafening. There are signs saying Kennedy everywhere. It's so loud in here. People really like her. Here's Caroline Kennedy.
Okay.
I'm here tonight I'm here tonight to pay tribute to two men who have changed my life and the life of this country, Barack Obama and Edward M. Kennedy. Their stories are very different, but they share a commitment to the timeless American ideals of justice and fairness, service and sacrifice, faith and family. Leaders like them come along rarely, but once or twice in a lifetime, they come along just when we need them the most. This is one of those moments. As our nation faces a fundamental choice between moving forward or falling farther behind, Senator Obama offers the change we need. Everywhere I go in this country, people tell me that Barack Obama is making them feel hopeful the way they did when my father was president. It's partly the words he uses, words that remind us that we are all in this together and that we each have something to contribute to this country that has given us so much. But it's the life he's led that is the true source of this inspiration, a life spent fighting for ordinary people in neighborhoods and courts, in the state Senate and in the United States Senate. I've never had someone inspire me the way people tell me my father inspired them, but I do now, Barack Obama. And I know someone else who's been inspired all over again by Senator Obama. In our family, he's known as Uncle Teddy. More than any senator of his generation, or perhaps any generation, Teddy has made life better for people in this country and around the world. For 46 years, he's been so much more than just a senator for the people of Massachusetts. He's been a senator for all who believe in a dream that's never died. If you're no longer being denied a job because of your race, gender, or disability, or you've seen a rise in the minimum wage you're being paid, Teddy is your senator, too. And if your children are receiving health care thanks to the Children's Health Insurance Program, if you see a nurse at a community health center, or if you're benefiting from the Medicare program that he fought to create, and just last month he returned to the Senate to save, Teddy is your senator, too. If your child is getting an early boost in life through Head Start or attending a better school or can go to college because a Pell Grant has made it more affordable, Teddy is your senator, too. And if you're an 18-year-old who's going to vote for the first time, and I bet it will be for Barack Obama, Teddy is your senator, too. Not only has Teddy helped put the American dream within reach for so many families, he's been a powerful force around the world for human rights and human dignity, for refugees and the dispossessed. He helped end apartheid in South Africa and bring peace to Northern Ireland. He's been a leader on arms control, and he took a strong, early, and courageous stand against the war in Iraq. He's a man who always insists that America live up to her highest ideals, who always fights for what he knows is right, and who is always there for others. I've seen it in my own life. No matter how busy he is, he never fails to find time for those in pain, those in grief, or those who just need a hug. In our family, he's never missed a First Communion, a graduation, or a chance to walk one of his nieces down the aisle. He has a special relationship with each of us. And his 60 great nieces and nephews all know that the best cookies and the best laughs are always found at Uncle Teddy's. Whether he's teaching us about sailing, about the Senate, or about life, he has shown us how to chart our course, take the helm, and sail against the wind. And this summer, as he faced yet another challenge, he and Vicky have taught us all about dignity, courage, and the power of love. And this... In this campaign, Barack Obama has no greater champion, and when he's president, he will have no stronger partner in the United States Senate. Now it is my honor to introduce a tribute to Senator Edward M. Kennedy.
The sea, for me, has always been a metaphor of life. I mean, the sea is a constantly evolving, changing, shifting aspect of both nature and of life. That sort of exposure to the sea is both enriching and enhancing, and it's fun.
The sea, the wind, the outdoors. It is the most renewing, healing place for him, and always has been.
Okay, that's a good job.
Yeah.
Sweat it a little bit.
He loves getting out and sailing. I think he's never more at peace, and perhaps in some ways never more in touch with his family and his roots and his brothers than when he's out there sailing.
I grew up in a family that wanted to achieve in the sense of making a difference in people's lives.
I know that Ted Kennedy has always been unbelievably sensitive to the accomplishments of his brothers. They were his inspiration.
He has a legacy. He's done his very best to pick up where his two brothers left off.
Like my three brothers before me, I pick up a fallen standard, sustained by their memory of our priceless years together. I shall try to carry forward that special commitment to justice, to excellence, to courage that distinguished their lives.
He championed the cause of those who have been left out, the poor, the elderly, our children, those without education.
I was brought up to believe that, you know, to those to whom much is given, much is required. But it's really bigger than that. He really feels a moral obligation to do everything possible to make this world a better place.
I've heard Senator Kennedy say on many occasions that health care is not a privilege. It is a right.
As long as I have a voice in the United States Senate, it's going to be for that Democratic platform plank that provides decent quality health care.
Because of Ted Kennedy, people have things today, they're able to do things today, they're able to reach for the American dream in ways that they never imagined.
I first met the senator at something called Children's Congress through the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and he asked me to come to testify in front of Congress about stem cell research and the support for that. If I could help someone almost as much as Senator Kennedy's helped me, then I'd be a very happy person.
City Year has given the opportunity for the best of our young people to serve in the community.
He deeply believes that national service ought to be part of the everyday life of every single American.
He committed right away to introduce new legislation to take programs like City Year to scale, to make it possible for young people all over our country to serve our country.
He deeply believes in service. Even as a United States Senator, he's read every Tuesday at a local school in Washington, D.C. It's part of an Everybody Wins program.
We were signed up for this reading program, and I was assigned to read with Senator Kennedy as my reading partner. It gave me someone to want to do well for and make proud. I'm going to Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, and I'll be majoring in education.
We're talking about a man of incredible sensitivity. He has always been there for the troops. He's always been there understanding the sacrifices that those troops made. He's been there for their families.
We met Senator Kennedy for the first time in November 2003 when we buried our son John at Arlington National Cemetery.
their son was lost because his Humvee was not up-armored, and they've really dedicated their lives to making sure that other young men and women don't suffer the same fate.
John died just after his 20th birthday. Senator Kennedy agreed to call hearings. Within 6 months of those hearings, all troops in Iraq had body armor. And to that, I owe the senator.
Brian and his wife, Alma, turned that enormous personal tragedy into a remarkable force for change.
Senator Kennedy had been a Gold Star family before I was born. He remembers where his mother was, where his father was, when they came to tell him his brother Joseph was killed. We share a wound that doesn't heal. And in a deep and abiding love for this country. And Senator Kennedy taught me that government can function for the common man.
His patriotism, his family, his faith, really, those three things are just intrinsic to who he is. You know, I think of him as this guy who's got really, really big shoulders, and he's strong for all of us, and he's funny, and he sort of leads the way. He's the Pied Piper in our family.
Well, let's count them. What do we call the one that's way, way, way up at the tipping point?
What is that? The halyard? The fisherman?
Fisherman! Don't tell me you want to put the fisherman on the other side now, Dad.
In spite of all of the changes, in spite of all of the progress, Senator Kennedy would tell us that we still have a great distance to go.
In the year I was born, President Kennedy let out word that the torch had been passed to a new generation of Americans. He was right, it had. It was passed to his youngest brother. From the battles of the 1960s to the battles of today, he has carried that torch, lighting the way for all who share his American ideas.
This moment is the moment for us to get health care done. And Ted Kennedy wants to be leading the charge where he ought to be, the head of that committee, making sure that he's working with President Obama to get health care for all Americans.
We'll break the old gridlock and finally make health care what it should be in America, a fundamental right for all, not just an expensive privilege for the few.
I see the day when President Barack Obama and Ted Kennedy will be moving progressive legislation through the Congress to help some of the most vulnerable people in our society.
The people in this country are going to respond in a hopeful and positive way. It's going to be a very, very dramatic and important alteration and change. And it's one that I'm looking forward to being part of.
My friends, I ask you to join in this historic journey, to have the courage to choose change. It's time again for a new generation of leadership. It is time now for Barack Obama.
Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Edward M. Kennedy!
Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Caroline. My fellow Democrats, my fellow Americans, it is so wonderful to be here. And nothing, nothing is going to keep me away from this special gathering tonight. I have come here tonight to stand with you, to change America, to restore its future, to rise to our best ideals, and to elect Barack Obama President of the United States. As I look ahead, I am strengthened by family and friendship. So many of you have been with me in the happiest days and the hardest days. Together we have known success and seen setbacks, victory and defeat. But we have never lost our belief that we are all called to a better country and a newer world. And I pledge to you that I will be there next January on the floor of the United States Senate when we begin the great struggle.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
For me, this is a season of hope. New hope for a justice and fair prosperity for the many and not just for the few. New hope. And this is the cause of my life. New hope that we will break the old gridlock and guarantee that every American, north, south, east, west, young, old, will have decent, quality health care as a fundamental right and not a privilege. We can meet these challenges with Barack Obama. Yes, we can, and finally, yes, we will. Barack Obama will close the book on the old politics of race, gender, and group against group, and straight against gay. And Barack Obama will be a commander-in-chief who understands that young Americans in uniform must never be committed to a mistake, but always to a mission worthy of their bravery. We are told that Barack Obama believes too much in an America of high principle and bold endeavor, But when John Kennedy thought of going to the moon, he didn't say, it's too far to get there. We shouldn't even try. Our people answered his call and rose to the challenge. And today, an American flag still marks the surface of the moon. Yes, we are all Americans. This is what we do. We reach the moon. We scale the heights. I know it. I've seen it. I've lived it. And we can do it again. There is a new wave of change all around us. And if we set our compass true, we will reach our destination. Not merely victory for our party, but renewal for our nation. And this November, the torch will be passed again to a new generation of Americans. So with Barack Obama, and for you, and for me, our country will be committed to his cause. The work begins anew. The hope rises again, and the dream lives on.
Okay, we're apparently having some more audio problems. I'm sure Mark will try to get that cleared up rather quickly. Stunning business. Nope, still a mess. So hopefully, like I said, we'll get that cleared up in a minute. Truly, that was a... I would have expected nothing... Nothing other than what he gave us, namely that he swore he would be there for the new Senate on January 20th. And I believe if it is at all humanly possible, he will. He absolutely will. And when I compare what that family has done for this nation to, say, the Bush family and what they have done to this nation, it seems abundantly clear to me which one is by far the greater value. Just a sec, please. This is, hang on a minute. Here we go. See, this is why there are producers and engineers, and because it's really kind of weird to try to do it all one person, or even two people, because keeping keeping one's presence of mind is a challenge under certain such circumstances. Are you there, Mark? Mark Levine, are you there? I'm sure you're just loving listening to me type. Okay. I'm still a mess. All right, Mark. All right, that's frustrating. This is a bad sign, and Guy and Mark will obviously have to talk to the... Yeah, that's what we're doing, Ben. But they'll have to talk to the authorities there because, it sounds to me like there's not enough bandwidth going to, not enough bandwidth going to Mark and Guy's connection. All right, let's try now.
Well, I found the culprit. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, what was the culprit?
The culprit was a damn McAfee thing that tried to update just in the middle of all this. Anyway.
Oh, brother. Okay, well, that would account for it.
Let's get past that and talk about the emotion in this hallway. I'll tell you, when I heard that speech, I was in the brink of tears, and people to my left and my right were, and this is the press. I mean, the delegates were, people were in stunned silence. Every seat was full. There are people in the aisles. And, you know, as he was leaving the stage, it was like people didn't want to leave. It's like they just kept clapping and hoping he'd meet one more person on stage. I mean, as I watched Ted Kennedy walk off the stage, I thought, is that the last time I'm ever going to see that man in my life? I used to work with Ted Kennedy. I mean, I discussed legislation with him. obviously, me and tens of hundreds of thousands of other people, but, I mean, I took it personally. This was a guy who is a guy. I shouldn't say was. The fact that I say was, even that bothers me. But this is a guy who I can't think of any other who stood up for liberal principles, democratic principles, the little guy as much as Ted Kennedy. And I don't know. It's just very, very powerful. Bob, what do you have to say?
Oh, well, you know, that family, Mark. John, Bobby, Ted, has one American family, short of perhaps, the Sullivans or in World War II, has one American family given more to this country than that family has?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I can't think of one. I mean... The Roosevelts, if you include Teddy and Franklin in the same one, I don't know.
But it's such a...
I forget it. I the Kennedys more so because, you know, they had adversity. The Roosevelts, it seemed, both Teddy and Franklin, they had things going their way. I mean, the irony is I say that when Frank FDR had polio. But, I mean, has any family not only given so much but struggled so much? I mean, it seems like every one of them has a tragic ending. I'm sorry, I'm breaking up here. I'm a little emotional.
Yeah, I can tell you're a little bit choked up.
I am.
Well,
and
there was that mention of a torch being passed.
Yeah.
And the question is, who picks up that torch in that family next? And you'd like to see Bobby Jr. do that.
You know, I don't mean to be mean on such a day, but he's not the same. I mean,
I beg to differ. I mean, he's
okay.
I've met him personally. I've had a conversation with him, and he
means well. I don't mean he doesn't mean well. I think he's a good man who means well.
He brings a great deal of his father's passion to bear. He really does. I think he has.
All right, all right. Maybe I'm just very partial to.
Well, no, I think Robert Jr. has a hard time bringing that to bear publicly because of the malady that he suffers from that makes speech difficult.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Because Ted Kennedy's oratory has always been soaring and bigger than life and. But you know what I said while we were having the audio troubles that I have complete faith that when he says that he will be there when the Senate gavels in January, that if one human being on Earth under these circumstances can do that, Mark, it'll be him.
Bob, I believe in the will to live. I've always believed in the will to live. Not that you can forcibly live, 20 years past your time, but a few months past your time, I've seen it. I've seen it in people I know. I've also seen people give up and die quickly. I mean, there is something to be said for the power of the mind over the body. And again, I'm not arguing, for any kind of crazy healing thing. I believe in medical science, but I do believe that you can extend your time, maybe a few months. And I think you're right. I think Ted Kennedy, if Barack Obama is elected, and I sure hope to God he is, I think Ted Kennedy will live to see that day.
Well, I think we had some audio earlier. Didn't I hear something earlier, Mark, where someone was talking about one has to be careful because this kind of rhetoric seems to be something that we hear every 4 years, and it seems to get a little bit more strident every time through. That this is the election that will change the face of the nation, change the generation. And I guess it's been used with every presidential election, but it seems to have a special poignancy this time through, don't you think? I mean, we really are at the crossroads.
I feel like Ted Kennedy is sort of the prophet in the wilderness. Jeremiah, pick your favorite prophet, Isaiah. The guy saying, hey, we are on the wrong road, and I'm dying, or Moses, if you want. I will not live to see the promised land, but I will bring you to it. And I guess really Moses is the right one. I mean, someone who has led us this far will not see probably, I don't know. I don't know if he'll ever live to see universal health care. I sure hope to God he does. I really do. If he could just make it, if Obama's elected, I mean, that's first on the agenda. And it'll go right through the House. Those of you that criticize Nancy Pelosi, I assure you, she will get universal health care right through. And if we get 56, 57 Democrats, as I think we will in the Senate, then three more shouldn't be that hard. Three Republicans probably will be enough.
With stakes like that, you don't think that they'll make a unified stand?
They may. We need to get 60. I'm trying to be realistic here. By the way, 58 is not out of the question. Not at all. I mean, 60 is not impossible. It's just really, really hard. But I think we're going to get at least 56 and 58, 59. The closer we get to that magic, unfilibusterable number of 60, the closer it is that Ted Kennedy will live his dream. And it reminds people, or should remind people, this isn't just about an election for president. It's just as much about election for Congress. And if you don't like how the Democratic Congress is doing, if you elect more liberals and more progressives, then you can get a Congress that does what you're doing. Not just a Democratic majority, but a progressive majority.
Well, exactly that. And I had the story earlier during my show, and I was a little bit harem-scarum because, it's just been a very long day for you, for me, for all of us.
Oh, yeah.
But this story, of the American airstrike in Afghanistan over the weekend that killed 90 people and 50 of them were little children. I'm really frustrated at this point, Mark, with those people who keep repeating the Naderite mantra of there's no difference between the two. There's no difference between the two. It's like they're Dorothy, and if they just click their heels and say there's no difference between the two, there's no difference between the two, there's no difference between the two, that it'll somehow come true. But you know what?
Well, we can thank those people for George W. Bush. I firmly believe that. I firmly believe that. If you voted for Nader in 2000, heck, if you lived in New Hampshire or Florida and you voted for Nader in 2000, yeah, I do blame you for George W. Bush, and I'm not taking it back. If you disagree, you can call in.
Well, yeah, I understand that. But, you know, look at my little home state here, West Virginia. We hadn't voted for a Republican presidential candidate since, you know, Eisenhower.
No, that's not. Oh, you mean, oh, right.
Dukakis, for God's sakes. Dukakis right. Carried West Virginia.
Right. What happened in 2000?
Well, what
was it? Gore didn't like guns enough? Was that it, Bob? Was
that it? That was a big part of it. They literally brought Charlton Heston to the Raleigh County Armory, where he stood up with a musket in his hand and said, "You can have my gun when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers." And
you know, the sad thing is, I know Al Gore. He didn't want to ban any guns. He just wanted to register them. We register cars. I mean, is someone going to say, no, don't take my car away? I mean, I'm sorry. It's not just your state, Bob. I don't mean to say it's only your
state. No, but we're five electoral votes. If West Virginia,
a lot of Americans are awfully ignorant.
If West Virginia had done what West Virginia did in every previous presidential election and just gone Democratic, Florida wouldn't have mattered. The Nader voters in Florida wouldn't have mattered. Those apparently confused old Jewish retirees voting for Pat Buchanan in Palm Beach County wouldn't have mattered.
You know what's sad about all of that? It's for all the mocking they've undergone, and many of them, you know, can't see very well, and the ballot was badly designed. All that proves, at the end of the day, is that the majority of Floridians, of course, preferred Gore. I mean, they even preferred him without the 10,000 on the butterfly ballot. But what's interesting to me is Republicans never denied that most Floridians wanted Gore. Of course most Floridians wanted Gore, but, you know, if you're old, maybe you shouldn't be voting.
I really don't think that there are any old Jewish retirees in Palm Beach County who voted for Pat Buchanan.
No, not at all. In fact, when I worked as a Nazi hunter in the Justice Department, every single Nazi we hunted, every single one, these were all, you know, people who were committed horrible atrocities in the death camps, came to America. We invited them in, our good old CIA, to fight against the communist menace. Anyway, every single one of them we tried to deport, and I built a case against two of them. There was an op-ed article by Pat Buchanan defending their right to stay in the country. As far as Buchanan was concerned, yeah, they killed 20,000 people, Von Braun did, but he can help us in our space program against the Russians. So, no, I don't believe any of those elderly retirees in Florida purposely chose Pat Buchanan.
And, you know, Pat Buchanan has gone completely off the deep end. Did you run across this audio from his appearance on the White Power radio show?
Really?
Oh.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me that he thinks that way, but it does surprise me that he would allow himself to be shown to be thinking that way.
Oh, and I mean, it was, and the thing is, it was a level, Mark, it was a level of hate that I think even for Pat Buchanan we would find.
You know, Buchanan
disturbing.
has always been hate with a kind face. He's always been the Klanner with a nice smile who's got a lot of friends in the press. You know, America's Klanner. You know, the guy who can hate but make it seem worthwhile. He's a very strange dude. You know, I mean, he was right on the war, but you know, but that doesn't matter. I've heard people say, "Well, you might kind of like Pat Buchanan. He was right on the war." Yeah, he was right on the war and wrong on everything else, but. Anyway, we're getting far afield.
We kind of are, but not really, not that much so. Because all of this ties together. This is a fundamental question of the direction this country takes. And you know, I'm not a political naif. I'm not a political waif. I didn't I was born at night, not last night, and Ms. Kincaid didn't raise no dummy. I don't have any misgivings whatsoever that Barack Obama is very much the centrist. But as compared with 0894, he's a decidedly better choice.
Well, obviously.
And you know
obviously.
But for the people who, you know, who say that they, you know, they want to go out and vote for Nader, they want to go out and vote for McKinney.
Well, you know, look, I hear from our audience, and I love our audience, but and people love Dennis Kucinich, and I got to say, there are many, many things where I prefer Dennis Kucinich over Barack Obama, but it's not realistic to think that Dennis Kucinich at the present time could win a majority of Americans.
Well,
he's not
in the race. There's two horses.
No, exactly. Right.
There's two horses in the race now. There's horse A and horse
B. Right.
And,
right.
And
you can vote for Kucinich in the primary, but now there's horse A and horse B. Exactly.
Right. And you know, if you want it to be different, obviously that means that there's got to be more work done in the primaries. But it, you know, I've come up with a new word, and it's mean, and I'll probably get some hell for this, but you know, to heck with it. I've come up with a word, and okay, here's the word. Tell me if you can define it. Naderbation.
You know, let me explain what I think it is. And I've met many Naderbaters. I have. I had a woman, I remember, I was in Boulder, Colorado, this very state, appearing at the Conference on World Affairs, which is very interesting because they invite all kinds of people from across the country, people on the left, people on the right. But Boulder, of course, is extremely liberal. So it's kind of fun to be there. We liberals get cheered and the right people on the right get booed. But sometimes there are people in the audience, I don't know if left is the right word, but let's just say out to lunch. I remember this woman talking about all the things that, yes, the Democrats had failed to do, and I don't deny most of them. But then she said, so you know what? I'll show them. I won't vote. And I said right away to her, then you're the problem. And I got a standing ovation. She walked out.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't vote. Well, I won't vote. I mean,
well, look, okay,
take my marbles and go home.
Yeah, but let me be honest, Mark. When I go into my polling place in November, I've got races I'm going to vote in. But I've got races where the Democrat
is... You've got Jay Rockefeller on the ballot.
Right.
Poor you.
And I'm not going to vote for his freakish Republican opponent.
Right.
But I damn sure don't have to vote for him, and I'm not gonna, and nobody can make
me. I'll tell you what, Bob. If it were a close election in West Virginia, and it won't be, but if it were 50-50 hairbreadth, I would say to you, I would really push you to vote for that bastard, and I think he is a bastard. I do not like Jay Rockefeller at all. Given that he's going to win in a landslide, you go ahead and vote your heart. Absolutely. And by the way, I said the same thing to Nader supporters. If you live in New York, if you live in California, if you live in Massachusetts, heck, if you live in Texas or Utah, you want to vote
or Alabama,
you go right ahead. I have no problem with that. I know how our system works. I know how the Electoral College works. So do you. If you live in Alabama or New York, you know, Massachusetts or Texas, vote for Nader, vote for Kucinich, vote for anybody. But if you live in Florida or Ohio or Colorado or Virginia,
Pennsylvania,
or New Hampshire,
yeah,
then you are harming the cause that you claim to believe in. And that kind of hypocrisy actually angers me more than someone who is a true believer, drink the Kool-Aid and votes for McCain. Because those people that vote for McCain, well, they're just idiots. But they're not knowingly sabotaging the things they believe in. You know, they may be extremely rich people and want a tax cut because they make $10 million. They may be, heads of oil companies. They may be, relatives of Charles Keating.
You heard about McCain. You heard about the billboard that the Daily Show has put up in Minneapolis, right?
I have not. Tell me about it.
It's very prominently displayed. It's on if you've just landed and you're coming from your flight into Minneapolis on I whatever it is, great big billboard, Jon Stewart, the Daily Show team, and underneath it says, "Welcome rich white oligarchs."
That's hilarious.
And those are the people that I do expect to vote for McCain. But
I don't know if you want to hear Senator Tom Harkin.
Oh, I like Senator. Yeah, let's go to him, please.
Okay, let's go to him. It's interesting. He's introducing the Republican, or the former Republican, that's going to speak next, former Congressman Jim Leach. But here's Tom Harkin. He's now talking in sign language. That's interesting.
We are so proud to have your support for Barack Obama for president.
He did the sign language and she translated. Now here's Tom Harkin.
You know, we Iowans have a strong, vibrant, two-party political system. However, we don't genuflect to ideology. We value thoughtful discourse rather than slogans and posturing. We hold very dear our freedoms. As our state motto declares, our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain. We're willing to do what's right, not necessarily what's easy. And nobody exemplifies the Iowa spirit more than Jim Leach, our thoughtful, respected, longtime former Republican congressman from Iowa. Back in the early 1970s, Jim was a foreign service officer in the Nixon administration. He served as a delegate to the Geneva Disarmament Conference and the United Nations General Assembly. But when Richard Nixon fired his attorney general and the independent counsel investigating Watergate in 1973, Jim resigned in protest. Two years later, he ran for Congress and won. Over the next 30 years, Jim stood for election 14 more times in my state of Iowa. He served three decades in the House of Representatives. He chaired two committees. He ran two national organizations dedicated to Republican causes. And he did all of these things as a strong, proud, influential Republican. At a time, my friends, when some would have us believe that America is a nation divided by red states and blue states, Jim is here today because he knows that red and blue are not nearly as important as red, white, and blue. So, ladies and gentlemen, my fellow delegates, it's my pleasure to introduce a fellow Iowan, a thoughtful, lifelong Republican, and a proud supporter of Barack Obama as the next President of the United States, Congressman Jim Leach from Iowa.
Thank you, Tom Harkin. As a Republican, I stand before you with deep respect for the history and the traditions of my political party. But it is clear to all Americans that something is akilter in our great republic. In less than a decade, America's
Well, it's happening again, and I don't think that it's going to get any better. So, okay, I'm waiting to see what's going on. Just a minute. Okay, let's see if things get well again. Are you there, Mark? No, okay. Okay, at any rate, unless I can get Mark back here, I think we're probably... All right, he wants a chance to fix it. Okay, Mark, that'll be fine. All right, so here. Hopefully we'll be back with Mark in just a moment or so. Wow, what a day. And these are good. You know, I would assume that we will be on the air somewhere around noon Eastern time tomorrow and each day following. And we will make this work, and we will make it be what it is. I mean, we'll make it work. Today has been some... today has been largely technical. And thank heavens that most of this was stuff that we could tech through. But it'll get better. I promise you that. All right, let's try this one more time.
Got my feet again, I hope.
Yes, okay, you're better now.
Okay, I think when someone came up here, it's very crowded here, and I think, in fact, I know, someone stepped on a wire. My Ethernet cord was kind of dangling a bit. I don't think it was fully in the computer. But we are back. The person who's speaking is former Congressman Jim Leach of Iowa, who's a former Republican, and sure sounds like he's a Democrat now. Let me go right to his feed, if I can.
Okay, great.
...with a country that did not attack us. The party that formerly led the world in arms control has moved to undercut treaties crucial to the defense of the earth. The party that prides itself in conservation has abdicated its responsibilities in the face of global warming. And the party historically anchored in fiscal restraint has nearly doubled the national debt, squandering our precious resources in an undisciplined and unprecedented effort to finance a war with tax cuts. America has seldom faced more critical choices. Whether we should maintain an occupational force for decades in a country and region that resent Western intervention, or elect a leader who in a carefully structured way will bring our troops home from Iraq as the heroes they are. Whether it is wise to continue to project power largely alone with flickering support around the world, or elect a leader who will follow the model of General Eisenhower and this president's father and lead in concert with allies. Whether it is prudent to borrow from future generations to pay for today's reckless fiscal policy, or elect a leader who will shore up our budgets and return to a strong dollar. Whether it's preferable to continue the policies that have weakened our position in the world, deepened our debt, and widened social divisions, or elect a leader who will emulate John F. Kennedy and relight a lamp of fairness at home and reassert an energizing mix of idealism abroad. The portfolios of challenges passed on to the next president will be as daunting as any since the Great Depression and World War II. This is not a time for politics as usual or for run-of-the-mill politicians. Little is riskier to the national interest than more of the same. America needs new ideas, new energy, a new generation of leadership. Hence, I stand before you, proud of my country, my party's contributions to American history, but as a citizen, proud as well of the good judgment of the good people in this good party in nominating a transcending candidate who I am convinced will recapture the American dream and be a truly great president. The senator from Abraham Lincoln State, Barack Obama. Thank you.
Please welcome to the podium, Austin, Lily, and Maddie Esposito.
I should say that I always liked Jim Leach. I worked with him in Congress, and he was one of the few Republicans always willing to co-sponsor our bills. Now I know why. He actually had a heart.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, Mark. I mean, on general principles, it's easy to demonize Republicans, all right, because of the way they've behaved for the last, 25, since Reagan.
Right.
But there have been principled Republicans in the past. When Howard Baker all alone marched up to the White House and looked at Richard Nixon and said, "Dick, you're out of here, buddy. It's over."
Right.
Now,
right.
Anybody who's read the account of those hearings and the congressional investigation of Watergate knows that the Republicans were doing everything that they could to save Nixon's bacon. But when it got obvious, even Howard Baker went and did the right thing.
Yeah, I don't think the Republicans are in the same cloth anymore. The few that are leaving the party right and left. There's only one Northeastern Republican left that I respect. There's only one Republican I think I respect in Congress. I'll name him, Chris Shays of Connecticut. I mean, he and I don't agree on a few issues, but he's an honorable man. And I can't say that about almost any other Republican, which is really sad. Jim Leach is someone I would have said was an honorable Republican, but he's now an honorable Democrat. The person speaking now is the son of Senator Claire McCaskill. She'll be the last person to speak before the introduction to Michelle Obama with a video and then by her brother. Why don't we play a little about from Claire McCaskill's son, all right?
Sure, go ahead.
Victory speech in Iowa, Maddie told her, "Mom, if you taught us that if you believe in something, you are supposed to claim it, work for it, and fight for it with all you have." Maddie was right, and Mom knew it. Because this year, what's at stake is too important. So my mom stepped up and went to work for a man we can believe in, for change we can believe in. She's here tonight to do it again, our mom, Senator Claire McCaskill.
Stand before you tonight representing the great state of Missouri. And I've got to tell you, I am so proud of my kids. Weren't they terrific? Missouri is in the middle of our great country. We have a nice view. As you look around my state from the middle of America, you see the best of our nation. Rich land, beautiful forests, shimmering lakes, wondrous cities, and most of all, the people of Missouri. Good, hard-working, God-loving, family-centered, blessed with an abundance of common sense and a tough streak of Harry Truman-style independence. We don't call it the show-me state for nothing. Missouri is a place where our country comes together. We are not a red state. We are not a blue state. We are proud to be part of the United States. And this November, I am confident that Missouri will help Barack Obama be the next president of this country that we love. Barack Obama knows that what unites us as Americans is a belief in the common dream that in America, anyone can accomplish anything. He believes in our stories, American stories. It's the story of a woman who grew up of modest means in a small Missouri town. Her dad's family had the feed mill, her mom's the corner drugstore. She worked her way through college and law school, waiting tables, and went into public service. She now works for families of modest means as a United States Senator. That's my story, and it's an American story. It's the story of a man who grew up in central Michigan, where he worked at his family's shoe store. He worked his way through school while playing football at a small college and started from scratch to build a successful small business. That's my husband's story, and it's an American story. It's the story of a woman who grew up in a very small apartment on the south side of Chicago. Her dad went to work every day for the city at the water filtration plant, even though he had multiple sclerosis. She went on to school on student loans and became a working woman, raising two beautiful girls. That's Michelle Obama's story, and it's an American story. It's the story of a man who was brought up by a single mom and his grandparents. He put himself through school with odd jobs, scholarships, and student loans. He took a pass on big money. Instead, went to work helping families devastated by steel plant closings and dedicated his life to bringing people together through public service. Barack Obama's story is an American story. In America, all of us come from different places, but we come together because we want that dream of opportunity for all Americans. That's why it's not just your dream or my dream, it's the American dream. For 8 years, we have watched our government take care of the few, the powerful, and the extremely wealthy. We have seen our dream put at risk by George Bush's Washington. John McCain is running for 4 more years of the same old politics and the exact same failed policies that we had under George Bush. They did tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. They did everything big oil asked, and look where we are. Come on, America. Let's call on our common sense and stay focused on what's important. We cannot choose that path again. That's a risk the American people cannot afford to take. I have seen Barack Obama in the Senate. I have been by his side campaigning in diners and coffee shops. I know he will bring the change we need in Washington. I saw him take on both parties to help pass the farthest reaching ethics reform since Watergate. That's the change we need. I saw him run a campaign that hasn't taken a dime from federal lobbyists or PACs. That's the change we need. I know this son of a single mom will stand up for the dreams of our daughters, and I know that John McCain won't. There is only one candidate in this race who has fought for equal pay for equal work by America's women. That candidate is Barack Obama. There is only one candidate offering real tax relief for the middle class health care that's affordable and accessible, and protection of Social Security today, tomorrow, and forever. That candidate is Barack Obama. It all depends on how you see America, how clearly you see the best of America. John McCain has been in Washington for almost 30 years. Maybe that's why he has a campaign run by Washington lobbyists, and recently said the fundamentals of our economy are strong. In Missouri, we have a ringside seat to the real America, and I can assure you it looks much different. It's time for someone who understands the real America, the waitresses, small businessmen, single moms, and truck drivers fighting to live their dreams. That's the America that Barack Obama sees. He knows our stories because he's lived the American dream. From where I sit in the middle of America, I see a leader who knows that the American dream is not for a special few. It is for all of us, every single one of us. You know, a week ago, I walked into my 80-year-old mother's room to find my two daughters there. The three of them were huddled around the computer. My mother turned around and looked at me with a very proud smile and said, "We're G-chatting with Obama volunteers from all over the state." Don't tell me this campaign is not special. I have seen Barack Obama bring people together. Democrats, Republicans, independents, young and old. He makes us believe once more in the very best of our great country. Barack Obama is going to be one great president, a great president for one nation under God, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you, and yes, we can!
Well, there goes Claire McCaskill, of course. She was someone who many people thought might be considered as a vice presidential pick. Now, the only thing that's left is talking about Michelle Obama. And this is a video about her, which we'll play right now.
She's my baby. January 17th, 1964. That's her brother Craig on the left. We lived in an apartment on the south side of Chicago where her father worked at the city water plant, and I got to stay home with my children. Michelle was especially close to her daddy.
My father was in his 50s, and my sister would still sit on his lap and put her head on his shoulder as she used to do when she was a kid. And that sort of, in one picture, epitomizes their relationship.
Her dad was just a sweet man and a kind-hearted man and somebody who thought everybody should be treated with dignity and respect. And I think that carried over to Michelle.
We raised Craig and Michelle to go to college, but we teased them about how some people went away to college and never came back to their community.
My mom and dad would always say that if just a few people would come back and live in the community, it would make all the difference in the world. And we talked about that a lot.
She was very committed to the South Side of Chicago. She was very committed to using every bit of her skills and her talent to lift others up.
After law school, Michelle came back. And at first she worked for a big law firm. That was where she met Barack.
The firm was a buzz about this hotshot first-year law student from Harvard. His name was Barack Obama, and I thought, well, who names their kid Barack Obama? So I figured this guy has to be weird.
She was assigned as my summer advisor. I was late that day, so I don't think I made such a great impression, but she was dazzling.
When he first showed up, he was a little late, so I thought, well, maybe he didn't have his act together. But then when he walked in, he was very handsome, and he had this air of interesting in him that I didn't expect.
I didn't see a ring on her hand. So turned out she didn't have a boyfriend, but she was very resistant to the idea of some inner office dating. I asked her a couple times, and she was sort of pushing me off a little bit.
And then he made his big move.
Finally, there was a company picnic, and on the drive back, I offered to buy her ice cream. That is what put her over the top. That's what she said, you know, this guy knows how to treat a woman.
But the law firm wasn't right for her. All those years ago, we taught her to serve her community, and that's what she ended up doing.
Michelle came to work with us in the mayor's office, and after a couple of years, she went to work in Public Allies, which is an organization that mentored young people and gave them an opportunity to learn public service work. And she did this because this was important to her. It didn't matter that it didn't pay any money. This was important to her, this was her mission, and this was something she wanted to do.
I think Michelle has a gift for seeing the potential in people that they don't even know is there. You know, the Public Allies class had people that if you saw them walking down the street, you wouldn't assume that these people would be community leaders. But so many of them went on to careers and lives in public service that she must have some kind of uncommon gift in seeing that in people.
I'm really excited for people to see the Michelle that I knew, the Michelle who I miss in my day-to-day life, the Michelle who, through a casual joke or a comment or a hug in the corridor, who could make you feel like you could do anything.
Michelle was like a mom to so many people over the years. It's no surprise to me that she's been a wonderful, caring mother to her own children.
She's an amazing mom. I mean, for her, that's what life is all about, her children. The girls are extremely grounded, very loving, very smart, know right from wrong, and it's all about her kids.
Michelle was able to find the balance between career and being a mom. After Public Allies, she went on to create the Community Service Center at the University of Chicago and led community outreach for the university's hospitals. Michelle has always reached out to others. It was something I loved about my husband, too.
Michelle's compassion came from my father. And people came to him with their problems, and he always managed to have people go away feeling better than they did when they came to talk to him. I'm certain that that's where Michelle gets her compassion from.
So my father died very early from complications from multiple sclerosis, and I think about him every day when I think about how I raised my kids, because I remember his compassion. I remember the words, his advice, the way he lived life. And I am trying each and every day to apply that to how I raise my kids. I want his legacy to live through them. And hopefully it will affect the kind of first lady that I will become, because it's his compassion and his view of the world that really inspires who I am, who I want my girls to be, and what I hope for the country.
This is my daughter. When she was young, I remember how she would look up to us. Now, I look up to her. I hope America gets to know the girl we raised and the woman she became, because she is the most remarkable person I know. I wish my husband could see this day, but every day I get to see a piece of him in her. And for that, I am so proud and so blessed.
Good evening. I'm Craig Robinson, and Michelle Obama is my little sister.
Well, he just explained who he was.
Yeah.
Let's hear from
tonight,
Craig Robinson.
I want to introduce you to my sister, the girl I grew up with, the poised young woman I saw her grow into, the compassionate mother, aunt, and sister-in-law she is, the passionate voice for women and children she has become, and the type of first lady she will be. Sometimes when I look at the woman you're about to hear from, it's funny to think that this is the same person who used to wake me up early, and I mean early, on Christmas morning. This is the person who would play the piano to calm me down before my big games in high school. This is the person who, even though we were allowed only 1 hour of television a night, somehow managed to memorize every single episode of the Brady Bunch. But when I really think back, I can also see how the person she is today was formed in the experiences we shared growing up. Working hard, studying hard, having parents who wanted more for us than they had, and always being reminded that in this country, of all countries, those things were possible. Now, neither of our parents went to college. My father went to work right out of high school to help pay for his brother's college tuition. He worked at the water filtration plant for 30 years. We lost my father in 1991. And I know he's looking down on us tonight, so proud of his daughter. Not because of who she married, though he was a big fan of Barack, but because of the hard-working, brilliant woman she is. What she's accomplished in her own right, the mother she's become, and the values she's instilled in her daughters. My mother Marion is here tonight. She remains our family's anchor, and the sole reason Michelle was willing to campaign at all was because she knew that Mom was there to take care of the girls. When we were young kids, our parents divided the bedroom we shared so we could each have our own room. Many nights, we would talk when we were supposed to be sleeping. My sister always talked about who was getting picked on at school or who was having a tough time at home. I didn't realize it then, but I realize it now. Those were the people she was going to dedicate her life to. The people who were struggling with life's challenges. She has continued to follow that passion. She gave up a big job in a law firm to work in her community with a group called Public Allies. She trained a new generation of community leaders. She developed the University of Chicago's Community Service Center, connecting the university to the neighborhood that was blocks away, but often worlds away from its gates. And when I wasn't happy doing what I was doing, she was the one who encouraged me to go back to my first love, teaching and coaching. And today, I'm proud to be the coach of the Oregon State men's basketball team. Go Beavers! But she did take something away from that first law firm job. A young lawyer by the name of Barack Obama. Now, my sister had grown up hearing my father and me talk about how you can judge a person's character by what type of sportsman they are. So she asked me to take him to play basketball. And if you're looking for a political analysis based on his playing, here it is. He's confident but not cocky. He'll take the shot if he's open. He's a team player who improves the people around him. And he won't back down from any challenge. Together, I've watched Barack and Michelle strengthen each other. I've watched them create a home filled with love and grounded in faith. During challenging times, I've watched Michelle and Barack stand by each other. And I know they'll stand by you, the American people, now and in the future. So please join me in welcoming an impassioned public servant, a loving daughter, wife, and mother, my little sister and our nation's next first lady, Michelle Obama.
For Barack, running for president is nothing compared to that first game of basketball with my brother Craig. I can't tell you how much it means to have Craig and my mom here tonight. Like Craig, I can feel my dad looking down on us, just as I've felt his presence in every grace-filled moment of my life. And at 6'6", I've often felt like Craig was looking down on me too, literally. But the truth is, both when we were kids and today, Craig wasn't looking down on me. He was watching over me. And he has been there for me every step of the way since that clear day in February, 19 months ago, when with little more than our faith in each other and a hunger for change, we joined my husband, Barack Obama, on the improbable journey that has led us to this moment. But each of us comes here also by way of our own improbable journey. I come here tonight as a sister, blessed with a brother who is my mentor, my protector, and my lifelong friend. And I come here as a wife who loves my husband and believes he will be an extraordinary president. And I come here as a mom whose girls are the heart of my heart and the center of my world. They're the first things I think about when I wake up in the morning and the last thing I think about before I go to bed at night. Their future and all our children's future is my stake in this election. And I come here as a daughter raised on the south side of Chicago by a father who was a blue-collar city worker and a mother who stayed at home with my brother and me. My mother's love has always been a sustaining force for our family, and one of my greatest joys is seeing her integrity, her compassion, her intelligence reflected in my daughters. My dad was our rock, and although he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in his early 30s, he was our provider. He was our champion, our hero. But as he got sicker, it got harder for him to walk. It took him longer to get dressed in the morning. You know, but if he was in pain, he never let on. He never stopped smiling and laughing, even while struggling to button his shirt, even while using two canes to get himself across the room to give my mom a kiss. He just woke up a little earlier, and he worked a little harder. He and my mom poured everything they had into me and Craig. It was the greatest gift a child could receive, never doubting for a single minute that you're loved and cherished and have a place in this world. And thanks to their faith and their hard work, we both were able to go to college. So I know firsthand from their lives and mine that the American dream endures. And you know,
What struck me when I first met Barack was that even though he had this funny name, and even though he had grown up all the way across the continent in Hawaii, his family was so much like mine. He was raised by grandparents who were working class folks just like my parents, and by a single mother who struggled to pay the bills just like we did. And like my family, they scrimped and saved so that he could have opportunities that they never had for themselves. And Barack and I were raised with so many of the same values. Like, you work hard for what you want in life. That your word is your bond, that you do what you say you're going to do. That you treat people with dignity and respect, even if you don't know them, and even if you don't agree with them. And Barack and I set out to build lives guided by these values and to pass them on to the next generation, because we want our children and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them. And as our friendship grew, and I learned more about Barack, he introduced me to the work that he'd done when he first moved to Chicago after college. You see, instead of going to Wall Street, Barack went to work in neighborhoods that had been devastated by the closing of steel plants. Jobs dried up, and Barack was invited back to speak to people from those neighborhoods about how to rebuild their community. And the people gathered there together that day were ordinary folks doing the best they could to build a good life. See, they were parents trying to get by from paycheck to paycheck, grandparents trying to get it together on a fixed income, men frustrated that they couldn't support their families after jobs had disappeared. You see, those folks weren't asking for a handout or a shortcut. See, they were ready to work. They wanted to contribute. They believed, like you and I believe, that America should be a place where you can make it if you try. And Barack stood up that day, and he spoke words that have stayed with me ever since. He talked about the world as it is and the world as it should be. And he said that all too often we accept the distance between the two and we settle for the world as it is, even when it doesn't reflect our values and aspirations. But he reminded us that we also know what the world should look like. He said, we know what fairness and justice and opportunity look like. And he urged us to believe in ourselves, to find the strength within ourselves to strive for the world as it should be. And isn't that the great American story? It's the story of men and women gathered in churches and union halls, in high school gyms, and people who stood up and marched and risked everything they had, refusing to settle, determined to mold our future into the shape of our ideals. And it's because of their will and determination that this week we celebrate two anniversaries, the 88th anniversary of women winning the right to vote, and the 45th anniversary, of that hot summer day when Dr. King lifted our sights and our hearts with his dream for our nation. And I stand here today at the cross currents of that history, knowing that my piece of the American dream is a blessing hard won by those who came before me, all of them driven by the same conviction that drove my dad to get up an hour early each day to painstakingly dress himself for work, the same conviction that drives the men and women I've met all across this country, people who work the day shift, then kiss their kids goodnight and head out for the night shift without disappointment, without regret. See, that goodnight kiss is a reminder of everything they're working for. The military families who say grace each night with an empty seat at the table.
servicemen. The servicemen and women who love this country so much, they leave those they love most to defend it. The young people across America serving our communities, teaching children, cleaning up neighborhoods, caring for the least among us each and every day. People like Hillary Clinton. Who put those 18 million cracks in that glass ceiling so that our daughters and our sons can dream a little bigger and aim a little higher. People like Joe Biden, who has never forgotten where he came from and never stopped fighting for folks who work long hours and face long odds and need someone on their side again. All of us driven by the simple belief that the world as it is just won't do, that we have an obligation to fight for the world as it should be. And that is the thread that connects our hearts. That is the thread that runs through my journey and Barack's journey and so many other improbable journeys that have brought us here tonight, where the current of history meets this new tide of hope. And you see, that is why I love this country. In my own small way, I've tried to give back to this country that has given me so much. See, that's why I left a job at a big law firm for a career in public service, working to empower young people to volunteer in their communities, because I believe that each of us, no matter what our age or our background or our walk in life, each of us has something to contribute to the life of this nation. And it's a belief that Barack shares. A belief at the heart of his life's work. See, it's what he did all those years ago in Chicago, setting up job training to get people back to work and after-school programs to keep kids safe, working block by block to help people lift up their families. It's what he did in the Illinois Senate, moving people from welfare to jobs, passing tax cuts for hard-working families, and making sure women get equal pay for equal work. It's what he's done in the United States Senate, fighting to ensure that the men and women who serve this country are welcomed home, not just with medals and parades, but with good jobs and benefits and health care, including mental health care. See, that's why Barack's running, to end the war in Iraq responsibly, to build an economy that lifts every family, to make sure health care is available for every American, and to make sure that every single child in this nation has a world-class education all the way from preschool to college. What Obama will do as President of the United States of America. He'll achieve these goals the same way he always has, by bringing us together and reminding us how much we share and how alike we really are. You see, Barack doesn't care where you're from, or what your background is, or what party, if any, you belong to. See, that's just not how he sees the world. He knows that thread that connects us, our belief in America's promise, our commitment to our children's future, he knows that that thread is strong enough to hold us together as one nation, even when we disagree. It was strong enough to bring hope to those neighborhoods in Chicago. It was strong enough to bring hope to the mother he met who was worried about her child in Iraq. Hope to the man who's unemployed and can't afford gas to find a job. Hope to the student working nights to pay for his sister's health care, sleeping just a few hours a day. And it was strong enough to bring hope to people who came out on a cold Iowa night and became the first voices in this chorus for change that has been echoed by millions of Americans from every corner of this nation. Millions of Americans who know that Barack understands their dreams. Millions of Americans who know that Barack will fight for people like them, and that Barack will bring, finally, the change that we need. And in the end, after all that's happened these past 19 months, see, the Barack Obama I know today is the same man I fell in love with 19 years ago. He's the same man who drove me and our new baby daughter home from the hospital 10 years ago this summer, inching along at a snail's pace, peering at us anxiously through the rearview mirror, feeling the whole weight of her future in his hands, determined to give her everything he'd struggled so hard for himself, determined to give her something he never had, the affirming embrace of a father's love. And as I tuck that little girl in and her little sister into bed at night, you see, I think about how one day they'll have families of their own, and how one day they and your sons and daughters will tell their own children about what we did together in this election. They'll tell them how this time we listened to our hopes instead of our fears. How this time we decided to stop doubting and to start dreaming. How this time, in this great country where a girl from the south side of Chicago can go to college and law school, and the son of a single mother from Hawaii can go all the way to the White House, that we committed ourselves to building the world as it should be. So tonight, in honor of my father's memory and my daughter's future, out of gratitude for those whose triumphs we mark this week and those whose everyday sacrifices have brought us to this moment, let us devote ourselves to finishing their work. Let us work together to fulfill their hopes, and let's stand together to elect Barack Obama, President of the United States of America. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless America.
Well, howdy do. That was something.
That was really sweet, I thought.
I think, Mark, I thought it was beyond sweet.
Go ahead.
It was very effective, and it addressed. That was notice served to the family values crowd that if they want to continue to play that game, this campaign will jam it right back down their nasty right wing throats.
Speaking of family values, her daughters just joined her on the stage, and she gave them both a big hug. And there they are. Oh my God, what cute little girls!
Oh, they are. They're
waving to the crowd.
They're just precious. But
the little one is, she's got a great big smile.
Her brother's an impressive guy, too.
Yeah. I like the way she said, test him out, see how you play sports with him, because you can learn about somebody by the way they play sports. And he said that he was someone who wouldn't run from a fight, but he'd be generous with his teammates, took a shot when he could take it, and when he couldn't, passed the ball so his teammates could. I thought that was
it was good.
Pretty powerful.
And, you know, yeah. he holds an MBA in finance from the University of Chicago.
What strikes me is Oh, wait. Who are they waving at? Oh, they're waving at their dad on the TV camera. That's what that
Aww.
Is. Live in Kansas City, Missouri. Oh, look at the girls. Blowing her kisses. She's got a tooth missing, the little one.
No, I think that on family issues and
I didn't hear what Barack Obama just said. I think he said something about Michelle only speaking. This is Barack Obama.
Now you know why I asked her out so many times, even though she said no. You want a persistent president. Hey, Michelle, you were unbelievable, and you also look very cute.
Thank you.
That's Sasha.
And listen, I'm here with the Gerardo family here in St. Louis. This is Jim and Alicia, and like us,
Gerardo,
they've got daughters.
Oh, that's precious.
We've got Lindsay. And we've got Hannah, and we've got Grace over here. And they've just been wonderful hosts the whole time that we've been watching.
Daddy, what city are you in?
I'm in Kansas City, sweetie. And Malia, Sasha, how do you think Mom did?
I think she did good.
All right. I think so, too. Well, listen, I want you guys to look after the girls. Look after Mommy before I get there, and I'll see you guys on Thursday, all right?
I love you, Daddy.
Love you guys.
Love
I'm
you.
I'm getting a little choked up here.
Love you.
Love you, Daddy.
Love you, sweetie. You were great.
That was really nice.
Yeah.
It was just really heartwarming. You know, it's a family. This isn't McCain cheating on his first wife to marry the beer heiress. This is a family.
Yeah, this is what it means to stick together. Yeah, pull that audio down. There we go. So, what a day it's been. I think we've worked out a lot of hinks and kinks there, Mark.
I think we'll do better tomorrow with, you know, we figured out how the audio works. And I know my way around this place. And that was completely unexpected. Obviously, that wasn't in the program either, that Obama would speak himself. But it was sweet. It was heartfelt. It kind of reminded me politically of that moment when Al Gore finished his speech and gave his wife Tipper a kiss that lasted just a little bit long, but made you think, this is just a guy who really loves his wife.
Yeah.
And there ain't nothing wrong with that.
Ain't nothing wrong with that at all, and there's a whole lot of stuff right about it. And I think that's what hangs in the craw of the right wing, Mark, is they know that they've got the phony version of this, but we got the real deal.
Yeah. No question. And the other thing is that both of them, not just Barack Obama, who I knew about his humble beginnings, I guess I didn't realize how humble Michelle Obama's beginnings were. And I got to tell you, one thing that you got to think back to 92 when we had sort of a very different image of Bill Clinton, but one thing that always impressed me with him was his humble beginnings.
Right.
Not that that makes someone, you know, by definition a great president. I mean, the Kennedys didn't come from humble beginnings, and obviously I feel a lot of affection for
them. Bill's humble upbringing, Obama's and Michelle's all speak, Mark, to an American paradigm. The idea that hard work can be rewarded, that hard work and determination can get you to somewhere you want to be.
It also means that they don't forget where they came from. You know, they didn't marry the beer heiress. It's very easy to have seven houses when you marry the beer heiress, particularly after cheating with her, you know, on your first wife. This isn't about that. This isn't about money and homes and who you can marry that gives you millions of dollars. This is about, you know, sweet love between two people who really just want to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
It's amazing because there's so many of us that want to make the world a better place, and it seems we get drowned out by the corporations and the advertising and the struggle to make a living and all the, you know, struggles of cynicism of everyday life, all these people telling us we can't do things, and every day it's just like, okay, well, I have to sacrifice a little here, and maybe I have to give up my little values here, because I guess that's the way it's done. And these are two people that said, you know what? That's not the way it's done. We're going to change it. We're going to make it better for our daughters and for the rest of America, and we're going to try the best we can.
Well, you know, William Wordsworth defined it 200 years ago when he said, the world is too much with us. We lay waste our days coming and going, getting and spending.
Right.
And what we just heard was a negation of that. That it is possible to, it is possible to have a family life. And I get the sense from what I heard from Michelle Obama this evening, Mark, that he would like to, or that Barack and Michelle, they have a vision that says we need to make that possibility broader in America. That
right. That
if you're going to talk about family values, well, you know, Mark, most marriages in the United States break up not over him a romping with somebody else or her a stepping out on him. Most marriages in this country break up over financial issues. So if you really want to preserve the family, then it stands to reason that you can best strengthen it by making life a little bit better, not easier, but better in terms of...
Better and easier.
Yeah, in terms of economics.
Right.
But enough of that. We've got to close off for the night. It sure has been fun, Mark, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow.
I'll tell you this, Bob. I was the first one, I think, in this center. When I arrived, there were less than 100 people, I think, in this building when I arrived, you know, at 5, whatever. And now I'm beginning to think I may be the last one to leave. I don't know if I can keep these hours, but so far I'm inspired, and I'm going to keep trying. So I'm going to see everybody tomorrow. Guy and I are hosting the show from 12 to 6, and then, of course, Bob Kincaid. Tomorrow is Hillary Clinton's night. It will be interesting to see how she and Bill respond and whether they're good sports. I think they will be. I mean, I really think they also care about a lot of these values. Sure, they are ambitious people, but at the end of the day, they also are just trying to make life better. I think Hillary and Bill will do the right thing tomorrow.
Hey,
they were
brokered in the Ten Commandments when they went to the White House. So, you know, they know what it is to struggle. And that's the thing. So, Mark, thank you very much. You break down stuff, and we will talk to you on the morrow.
And thank you, Bob, for putting up with all our crazy audio issues. This isn't easy to do, but it's sure been fun to try. And I'll see you tomorrow.
All right, we'll get them tomorrow.
All right, take care, Bob. Bye.
You too, Mark Levine. And so the broadcast day will resume at noon Eastern Time tomorrow. That would be 9 a.m. Pacific. And I hope you will be here. Independent coverage of the Democratic National Convention, coverage that is not corporatized or sanitized or sterilized or anythingized, just the real deal of what's going on as it happens, with brilliant commentary by two of the best broadcast professionals in the business, in the form of Guy James and Mark Levine. So please stay with us. Join us again tomorrow. And in the meantime, since we are closing out Peter's program, a very, very hearty thanks to Peter for allowing us to fill these 2 hours in his absence with the Horns coverage of the convention. And in closing, as Peter would say, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you to...